Thank you very much for coming to this session. This is one of the breakout sessions on a how-to guide to measuring your own impact. We are part of the research team that you've been hearing about today based at the London School of Economics. We actually are working with colleagues at Imperial.
Sorry, it's really hard to hear you.
Is that, if I speak a bit closer, is that better?
Yeah, but you have to stay really close.
Oh.
You know, a microphone you can walk around with.
Oh, God. It's going to make me feel like
you can turn up the gain on it.
Yeah, so that it's louder.
I might just use this. Oh, God.
That's about I sit over there and press the thing, and you just sit down here. Sit down.
Oh, okay.
I will press the thing.
Could we bunch up as much as possible just to let as many people as possible in? Yeah, he's going to do the thing. I'm going to sit over
there. Can I move on to slide two?
Yeah, you can, yeah. Okay, I'll try again. How is this? Yes? Okay, good. So I'm going to be outlining in this presentation some of the findings of the research we've been working on over the last year around how to think about and measure your own impact. I should say there's a lot more detail in the handbook, of which you all now have a copy, so really there's no excuse.
It is
300 pages long. We had a lot to say, but there's a lot of detail in there as exemplified by the 300 pages, and so I'm just going to try and give a bit of an overview here.
And again.
So why is being able to assess your own impact important? To put this in context, there is a significant imbalance in the funding going to science subjects compared to STEM subjects, and that has been growing over the last 10 or 15 years. And we're now actually looking at significant cuts to the university sector as a whole. And so at this time, it's really important to be able to show the value of all academic research, but also as individual academics we want our work to be seen, read, used, and therefore to have impact. So where have we come to our conclusions from? The research team has put together a data set of 240 academics from across 10 social science disciplines from all across the UK. And as part of that, we looked at both their academic outputs, the citations to those, and then their impact footprint outside university, so their links into government, community, media, and business. This research forms the basis of the conclusions that we talk about in the handbook and the work that we're presenting today. And new findings will be updated on our blog as we go over the next year of the project. But what we know now is that there is no magic solution. There's no one right way to do this. But there are a number of practical things that you can do now. So let's start with academic citations. There are three main tools that you can use to track the citations to your academic work. There's the traditional bibliometric databases such as ISI Web of Science and Scopus, of which all of your university libraries will have access to. Now, these give very accurate citation counts for the literature that is actually included in them, but they only cover one type of output, which is academic articles. Now, this is very useful for some disciplines whose primary output type is academic articles. For other disciplines, maybe more humanity type disciplines, books are really the primary output, and therefore they're not very useful for that. For things like economics, because it takes so long to get an academic article accepted into a journal, actually sort of conference and working papers are much more cited output, and so it doesn't really pick up those kind of outputs. It's also very biased towards STEM disciplines, and I'll have a slide about that in a minute. It's also very US biased and very biased towards English language outputs. So those are the traditional bibliometric databases. We then move on to more open search, so Google Books, Google Scholar. Now these cover all publications, all types of publications, so that's great, but we don't know how they're compiled, we don't know what algorithms Google uses. So there can be a lot of duplications, a lot of mistakes, which are quite difficult to correct or account for. It also means that citations can become blurred and over-inclusive. So the third version is one that we're big fans of. These are tweaked versions of Google Scholar, and the one that we specifically use is one called Publish or Perish, which was developed by an academic working in Australia called Anne Will Harsing. And she's developed some software that uses Google Scholar and corrects for some of the problems that you get with open search. So when you put your name in and search for your publications, you get a big list up, and it enables you to merge records to take account of duplications. You're able to delete entries that aren't you, and pick particular years, pick particular subject disciplines. It also allows you to calculate some citation scores, which again I'll come on to after. At the moment, we don't see any downsides to this, but you know, these are early days. But at the moment, this seems to us to be the best tool to use. The point I made about inclusiveness, of not being ISI and databases such as those not being terribly representative for social sciences in particular, I think this slide shows it very well. This is looking at all of the items in ISI for articles submitted for the 2001 RAE. As you can see, medicine, biology at the top, up around between 90 and 100%, whereas social sciences, right down the bottom there, around about 25%. So there's just less social science outputs included in these databases. So once you've got your list of publications and citations, you need to look at some simple indicators. Obviously, you've got your total number of publications, you've got your total number of citations. You can actually look, obviously, citation per paper or at your total number. But you can also calculate a number of citation scores. Now, there's an H score, there's an age-weighted H score, and there's a G index. These all sound terribly. This lovely graph is trying to show a little bit about how the H-score and G-index works. The H-score basically is the number of outputs which each have that same number of citations. So if you have an H-score of 5, you have 5 outputs that each have 5 citations.
Or above.
Okay, so what we've got here is the number of papers along the bottom axis and the number of citations along the horizontal axis for each paper, if you see what I mean. And then the point where you get to the equal sign is the H score. And then, in addition, there's a very useful thing called the G index, where you just take this set of things that are above the H score and you calculate what the average citations is for these highly cited papers. And in the social sciences, it's quite common to find that the G index is twice as high as the H score. So it's everything we all want to. Because if you have just one or two really highly cited things, that will tend to not be captured by the H score. So it's useful to look at the H score and the G index. And all the age weighting does is it just controls for how long you've been publishing. The good news for those of us who are white-haired is that it's very good news for us, because takes a long time to accumulate citations. So you probably really need to use the age-weighted scores if you're comparing junior and senior colleagues. So
the age score was developed by a physical scientist called George Hirsch. One of the reasons I think he liked the age score so much is that it gave him a score of 110, which is extremely high, even for highly citing disciplines like physics. And that's an important point. You need to give some context to these numbers. So you need to look at where you are in terms of career progressions. As Patrick says, professors are generally going to have higher age scores than early years researchers. They've published more, they've had longer to disseminate their research, they're more often linked into networks. Also, certain disciplines have generally higher age scores than others. Medicine, physical scientists publish and cite a lot. Disciplines like engineering self-cite a lot, and so that pushes up their age scores. You also need to look a bit about how you work. From the research that we've done, we've found that the most impactful work is often multi-authored and multidisciplinary. Now, some people have told us that, especially around the RAE, they felt they were being pushed into publishing in a particular way, monographs in core discipline areas. And those, it's not to say those type of outputs won't have impact, but it may be that there are better ways to publish in order to increase your impact. Obviously, applied versus theoretical research, as we were hearing about this morning, the basic theoretical applied differences are going to affect your age scores. And also, there are different referencing patterns around hub and authority referencing. This slide is just to show the differences both in terms of career position and also discipline. This is taken from our data set, but just looks at five social science disciplines. And as you can see, economics professors right at the top there with an average age score of 7.5, down to law professors here at the bottom, which is just under 3. It's also quite interesting to note that the geographers in our sample, the lecturers, senior lecturers and professors, are all much closer in terms of their average age scores than the other disciplines. So generally we can say more senior staff have higher age scores, and averages across disciplines vary, which is why you need to take these into context. Do you mind if I come back to questions at the end?
Just about this slide.
Okay.
Is it measured on ISI or on Pulitzer Paris?
We used both ISI plus Publish and Perish, so this is an amalgamated version of the PPG. Bit of both, yeah.
It's a checked version of both.
Yeah. So here are some tips for increasing academic citations. I'm sorry if they seem a little bit basic, but the thing that has really surprised me when we've been doing this work is how rarely this stuff is written down. And I tell you, when you start Google searching across 240 academics, it really does give you an idea of what could be done better when we're trying to reference our work. If you have a very common name, James Brown, Paul Smith, it's really a good idea to pick an additional initial or something, four initials. Once you pick a name, then do stick with it. The amount of people in our sample who change names quite regularly, not change names, change the way they refer to themselves quite regularly was quite surprising.
Plan for a name that has global distinctiveness, not UK distinctiveness, but right across the World Wide Web distinctiveness, so that you can find it. Otherwise, you'll spend a long time with Harzing just trying to find yourself, let alone actually getting your real score. So if you have an undistinctive name, 3 or 4 initials isn't a bad idea, you know, plus your full first name.
We also talked a little bit this morning about choosing article titles, book titles. Sadly, much though I love them myself, in the world of Google, punning titles are no use. That isn't what people are searching for, and therefore they don't find them. As we've mentioned previously, working with colleagues to produce multi-authored outputs. This really just means you already have multiple networks that you can tap into when you're trying to disseminate your work. And it's really important that dissemination and impact plans are built into research projects early on. I think a real problem has been too often this has seemed as quite a tacked on the end, an afterthought after the research is done. And obviously it needs to be much more built into the process. The last point is one about putting versions of your work on the web. In order to have impact, your work has to be found. We found that social scientists, for example, as a group, are much less likely to put any versions of their work on the web than physical scientists. So although obviously you have to put your article into that particular journal in order to talk to a particular academic group of colleagues, but why not put an open version on the web, a blog post, or just use your university's online depository system to make sure that people who are interested in your area from either inside the university or outside are able to find it. We then move on to looking at external impacts. Now, we've seen a number of models of impact already today, and there are obviously a number of key factors involved. We've got eight here. But I just wanted to draw your attention to a couple. I mean, at one, we've got academic credibility, and this is a really key point because our data shows that external impact is closely related to academic impact. It's really unlikely that any kind of impact is going to come from poor quality scholarship. Impact doesn't replace scholarship. The other factors we've talked about around disciplines, experience, but also things like personal communication capacity and networks and external reputation. These are all aspects that our research is trying to find the interplay between all these different factors. So to find external impacts for our data set, we again used Google. We've searched across an academic's digital impact footprint to find where their work was being picked up. Was it in government reports, in campaigning literature from a community group, whether an academic was sitting on an advisory board or was a non-executive director? And just as with you needed context for the academic citation, again, context is needed here. These are very much related to the incentives that exist for academics in when they're trying to consider their own promotion, advancement, and the academic roles that they take on. So again, professors are more likely to have greater external impact than more junior colleagues. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean that early years researchers can forget about impact. They really can't, although the pressure on them to produce sort of their four ref outputs is very great. They have to be thinking about impact. This is very much the way that the assessment agenda is going to go forward. We know that the percentage of the ref that's going to be looking at impact is going to increase in later ref rounds. But in some ways, they have some advantages. They can be closer to networks of interest than some of their more senior colleagues. And also, they can be more open to new methods of communication, such as social media and blogs that we've been talking about today. I mean, academic roles also need to be taken into account. Well, one of the points that came out of the meeting this morning is that academics have a real time pressure here, and dissemination is only one of these roles that we all have to take on. If you have a heavy teaching load, if you're running a particularly large research project, if you're a head of department, these are obviously all going to affect your ability to be able to create the work and create impact. There is also, again, differences by discipline. I've only got three up here, so if you can see economists, political scientists and geographers here. And this is where we looked at the footprint of external impacts for the academics in the data set that we put together. Economists on over there we thought would have a much higher input into government, but actually we found their biggest link was to think tanks, who obviously are trying to influence government but using their research. The geographers had a much stronger link into the society groups, so community action, working with those type of groups. Political scientists seem to be mostly talking to librarians, which is quite an interesting finding for us. But I think that's because in our sample, political scientists, books were their biggest output type. So that's obviously talking to the librarian community there. So then we think about tips for increasing external impacts for individual academics. The most important one that I'm going to talk about is to create an impact file of all the information on your external interactions. Now, some universities ask you to collate this sort of information already. You're asked to tell them about the publications that you have, the seminars you speak at, the conferences you go to. But it's also important to detail information that isn't picked up in this way. So a meeting with a civil servant, a contact made at a seminar that resulted in a reference in a report. These pieces of information can only really be got from you, and they're quite difficult to remember in a year's time when somebody comes and asks you about them. So keep a record of them, even if it is a box in the corner of your room that you just print out the email and put it in there, so that you have a running collection of information. We also have been talking about multi-authored working. Think about different methods of disseminating your research outputs that are tailored to particular audience groups. The other session that's going on now is about research mediators, and our data set has really shown that these types of organisations can be invaluable in helping academic research reach target audiences. We'd also emphasise using all the available dissemination resources that maybe your university puts forward: online depositories, seminar series, blogs, knowledge transfer schemes. And this links onto the tips for universities and departments. Obviously, this is not just an individual academic's responsibility. Our institutions need to take some responsibility for this too. And a really important one is to provide a steer on the value of dissemination and impact that all of the academics in that university are working on. This shouldn't just be rhetoric, it needs to be incentivised through promotion and advancement processes. And really importantly, as we heard again this morning, that the time pressures on us all are growing. Universities also need to factor dissemination and impact into calculations of academic workload and time burdens. There are some more general things they can do: re-evaluating event and conference programmes. LSE has a very high profile event programme, and most of the research we showcase is not LSE research, it's from academics all around the world. Now obviously that's a valuable thing, but whether there should be maybe some more balance between the work that we showcase of others and the work that we showcase of our own academics. We also have a research depository online where they take care of all the copyright issues for you. All you need to do is send them a publication when you've done that, and they will sort that out and put it all online for you so that people can find the research when you've done it. They also run a blog server for us, which all our blogs that we do run off. And lastly, facilitating collaboration. We're all in this together. We're all working across these type of issues, and universities really need to think about facilitating collaboration and linking to dedicated expert teams or consultancies to make sure the staff have the information that they need to be able to work impact successfully. So, in conclusion, maximising academic and external impacts. It's helpful for your promotion, your career fulfilment, and actually it's going to get you more money. There are resources. There are resources available for this, as we talked about this morning. The HIFE, or Higher Education Innovation Fund, has just been given an additional £6 million that universities will be spending over the next four-year period. And looming over the horizon is the REF in 2010, where 20% of the funding will come from... 2014. Will come from impact assessment, and actually only 65% now is made up of research on the research outputs. And a four-star impact case study may bring in as much funding as 13 four-star publications. So these are really key to get these right. There are a number of ways to get involved in our research if you'd like to. We do have the handbook. We also are running a blog and an email and a Twitter. So we'd be really keen to get your comments on this. So do feel free to come back to us on any aspect of this.
So I think what we'd like to do now is take lots and lots of questions and maybe try and queue up two or three questions, and then we'll see what the answer is. Yes, in the middle.
Shall I start?
Yeah.
Going back to your slide of you mentioned some indicators of external impact. You mentioned think tanks, government press, etc.
Yeah.
My question is, did you ask the researchers to write this down, or did you, for example, press the data mine less is next? Or another? Is it data-driven, or is it just me mentioning myself?
It's data-driven.
You mentioned that the sources per... Well, I don't think it's in the handbook. The sources per indicator.
Okay. So, how did we... Well, for example, we looked at Google Web, and we looked for references in the widest possible sense to this person and their work. And if we've got it in think tanks, that's in think tanks. If we've got it in business, that's in business, and so on. So it's very much assumes that we're living in a digital world. And in this digital world, influence leaves electronic footprints. Now, we are moving on from this to the next stage of the work, where we are doing a big interview program, and we'll be trying to expand on the non-digital kind of things. But this is digital footprint work.
You kept it to a general Google kind of search.
Yes.
You didn't go into specific databases like LexisNexis or Government Online.
I think you'll find that the methods annex to the handbook does explain all this in some detail. If you've got any queries that are more detailed, come back to us and we'll be happy to respond. Let's take two or three more. Yeah.
Saskia Walcott.
Sorry, could I just ask you to wait for the mic?
Right, sorry. Saskia Walcott, communications consultant.
Is that
okay?
No.
Is that? Did it turn on?
Is it switched on? You're a communications consultant.
I know. Just shout if not.
I'll just shout.
Just shout. Right.
My question was about the media. Just thinking back to this morning's session, there were a lot of people there talking about. Work that's been generated or coverage they've generated in the media. I noticed there's something that didn't really crop up in the top tips that you put up. I just wanted to ask, obviously media coverage is not impact in itself, but how is that going to count in terms of, how would you advise people in terms of the REF and media activity?
Okay, good. Let's take two or three more.
Larry Buchanan, LSE. I'm detecting a certain blurriness in this presentation and also the ones this morning, in the sense there's an awful lot here about dissemination and engagement, but in relation, which dissemination might have some impact on your academic impact, but most of it's going to have not registered at all in terms of an external or non-academic impact. So a great deal of what's been said here has no payoff at all in terms of trying to ramp up scores for external impact. You can have as much engagement and dissemination as you like. If you don't deliver at the end of it, it's zero.
For external impact, as assessed by HEFPA.
Yeah. I mean, academic impact, I think all of us can pretty much take care of ourselves. It's the bloody external one, the non-academic one, that's the devil. And a lot of this stuff just isn't getting at it.
Okay. Thanks, Justin.
It's a practical issue about the blog server. Did you encounter any resistance from your institution in terms of the institution being the publisher of a blog, which can have upsides but also downsides? As I think LSE's experience. What are the
downsides, sir?
Well, if somebody writes a blog that causes significant controversy.
Well, that was a press release issued by the press office.
But my point is that everything on the website is published by the institution.
Right.
So how do you deal with that?
Okay, well, let's work through these. On the blog, we're doing a whole session on the blog afterwards, but basically our blog is very tightly edited. All the blogs we run are tightly edited. We can't vouch for everybody. Also comments are tightly edited. So we would, you know, they're refereed before they go up. They don't go up directly. We'd recommend that. The role of media, does it count in HEF? The answer is yes. If you look at a lot of the case studies, they cite media citation, individual media citations, for particular research-related outputs. But does systemic media coverage count? It's a lot less clear whether that's true, and that gets to Barry's point that a lot of these points that we're discussing here may not seem to have a payoff in terms of being referable. And we're not totally concerned with that. I mean, REF is a particular product of people who live in Hefke world, and what we're interested in really is the sort of more general thing. But on the whole, we don't think that anything that's here is going to harm your REF status. Whether it's going to help is, you know, I mean, narrative skills would be better. Fairy tale writing would be better, in my view, in terms of enhancing your case studies than most other things. So you could, you know, we've given some specific suggestions for enhancing REF case studies, and we'll be doing more work on that. But, you know, what we're interested in here is people genuinely trying to increase their impact externally as well as academically. Let's do some more questions. Yes?
Yeah.
Impact measures are mainly in there in terms of the RAE and the REF, which are panels.
So when you apply for funding, do you also need to respond to specific measures against impact on your funding?
It's all right, we'll take it now.
You take that. One more?
Yes.
For a point of addition reference with the ISI, ISI does have a books citation index, which they're bringing out, I think, quarter four this year. They've been a little bit sketchy about the dates, but that will certainly give you a citation count for books articles. It probably won't be an impact factor because standalone books can't have an impact factor, but it will certainly give an article count. I mean, how many years that takes to generate momentum, nobody knows.
Okay, well, let's start with those in reverse order. The books bit of ISI is forthcoming, and they have announced some agreements with publishers as to inclusion, but we're a little unsighted as to how inclusive this books element will be. ISI is essentially a very old system that dates back to the 1970s, and it's very, very orientated towards journals, and particularly towards physical science journals and towards American publications and against other languages. Now, they have been, you know, feverishly trying to respond to the challenge which Google Scholar really poses to ISI and to Scopus. But we would think that they're still on the back foot, and that they're going to be on the back foot on books. Similarly, Claire's point about mining ISI for book references, yeah, that's true, you can do it, but you have to be like Linda Butler, you know, the world's best bibliometrician, to do it. And it's a very partial data. Why would you want to bother? Why don't you just use Google Scholar in the Harzing version, which covers all the disciplines? Now, if you look at the argument that bibliometrics itself is inherently skewed against the social sciences or against literature or humanities and in favour of the physical sciences, there just is no shadow of proof of that if you're using an inclusive bibliometrics database like Google Scholar. So the problem about ISI is that less than 35% of most social science items are included in the ISI, which makes it an utterly useless basis for assessing anything, really. But that's not true of Google Scholar. Google Scholar is remarkably inclusive across all disciplines. So if, for example, you look in sociology, you'll find that the person with 35,000 Google citations is Scholar citations is Anthony Giddens, who's never done a quantitative bit of work in his life. So I just don't think that's true. It used to be true, and it is true of the ISI, but it's not true of Google Scholar. And if you're using the Harzing version, it's also additionally much easier and quicker to use, and everybody can use it. So it's an open source, well, it's not quite open source, but it's open source in terms of you can see everybody else's citations and they can see yours, and you don't have to be a professional bibliometrics person to use it. Now on...
I mean, all the UK research councils ask for an impact statement when you're applying for money, but they essentially, as was said this morning, ask you to forecast what your impact will be, which is obviously quite tricky to do. And they come back to you after you've had your money from them and ask you at 3 months, so how did your impacts go? Which I think, you know, when you read through the handbook, those aren't the timescales that impacts accrue over. So although they all ask you to make some statement about impact, they all, by the way, have a different definition of impact. So if you're applying to ESRC rather than AHRC, that's so I think it gives an idea that it's a bit confused, the thinking on it's a bit confused, and therefore maybe not actually quite as important to them as possibly it might be.
But this is one area where your H score, knowing your H score and G score, and assuming you want to quote them, could get you some money, because if you've got a decent H score and G score, it's quite likely that future work is going to be referenced. It's more difficult for people who are just starting out and so forth. But again, if you can show that you've got a good H score and G score against people of your age in your discipline, then that's likely to mean that you're going to get academic and external impacts. Let's do another round of questions, if there are still questions from maybe people who haven't asked already. Just to, yes, start at the back. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, this is
Mukulika Banerjee, Anthropology LSE. I have one very specific question and one very general question, which may or may not. I think it is relevant to the whole day, but you know, as especially being based here, I'm curious, and I think the two of you are the right people to answer. The very specific question is, in anthropology, of course, we have a bigger problem than a lot of other social sciences. Most people don't even know what it is. So, a colleague, for instance, just at lunch, was talking about having collaborated with artists as one of her dissemination exercises from a big two-year ESRC grant. What would be your specific advice on how you would cite that, for instance, to be counted up in the various biometrics? That's a specific question. The second one is, clearly what you're designing, and I'm completely with you in spirit about this sort of larger research that's feeding this report and the handbook, but this is a sort of third way to the ESRC model of impact and the REF model of impact, clearly the two of which are not speaking to each other. And we are coming up as academics on the basis of solid research saying that this could be impact. What kind of role do you think you, your project, the LSE, the wider social science community is about to play with in engaging in dialogue with HEFC and with the ESRC and other research councils in trying to influence or lobby their definitions of impact? Because clearly this is the time, isn't it? It's by the autumn that indicators will be firmed up.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. Yes.
Hi. John Nagins of Warwick. Just wondering if you or anybody else has looked at the impact of teaching and the dissemination of ideas through primary undergraduate or postgraduate teaching.
Very good. Well, can I just respond on these two here? Dr. Banerjee's point was about, first of all, collaboration with artists and so on. Do you want to handle this one?
No.
Yeah. we would have picked it up in our data set as part of the impact footprint. So you assume that the artists, you know, the work that you did together would have been there and that would have been picked up. So we would have just used it in that community kind of social group space, which in the Rosettas that we did would have been picked up there. We did find a lot of really interesting work going on in the social sciences, more usually in the sciences. I have to say the sciences work very well with artists, and that has got quite a long history and therefore is very well disseminated and very well linked into. We didn't find quite so much, although some interesting work going on, so we would have picked it up and we do see it as
well. I think it's worth bearing in mind now that we're moving beyond the age of footnotes and exclusively text-based evidence. So, you know, if you can take a digital photograph of it, if you can take a video of it, then you can pop it on the web, you've got a URL, you've got a hyperlink there that just goes straight to that, whether anybody clicks it, but at least you should.
But that needs to be done.
Yes, yeah. And of course you need to work on the ESRC and so forth so that they start to accept different kinds of things, except text, because they just currently have forms that only accept text, but at least you can put the URLs in. Now your second one was about what's the role of the wider role of this, and are we the third way? Oh dear, that would be a bad thing for an LSE person to be promoting, wouldn't it?
Consistent.
Yes. Well, I think we're at the very early stages of the impact agenda, and that we don't know what's going to work. So what we have really is in the impacts process in the REF, although I was sitting next to David Sweeney, I don't know if he's here at lunch, and he was going, "It's all perfect, I don't know what you're grumbling about." So he obviously thinks it's well of us. Well, there he is, right at the back. But I think it's at a very early and formative stage. And so I'd encourage everybody to have a think and to see what they think and to lobby HEFCE, because I think they really need to be told. If there's any widespread agreement with what we're saying, we'd like them to hear about it. But the same for the ESRC. I think it's obviously in the early days of defining the whole concept of impact. So I think if we can think about getting to a way in which we have an objective, measurable, demonstrable idea of impact, and not just a very inclusive, over-claiming kind of fairy tale of impact. I think we will all get better at it, and we're just in the beginning of the iterations. But whether this project has that effect or not, I think, let's hope so. And John asked about teaching and impacts, and that's a very interesting question. There have been some studies that show that 15% of British businesses report that the arrival of a new graduate who'd been taught a new skill, postgraduate, with an MSc or PhD, actually was quite crucial for them sorting out a project that they've got into difficulties with. So it isn't at all, again, the obsessive Hefke thing, this is research and that's teaching and that's not research, it's something else like integration activities. I think all of that sort of boundary drawing just cuts across the actual complexity of academic life and the way in which impacts are genuinely achieved by very hard-working academics, So I myself believe that teaching can have research impacts. For example, on our MPA program, we run four-month projects for groups of four or five students working with the OECD, the World Bank, the Cabinet Office Strategy Unit, the National Audit Office, and so on. And the piece of research that comes out of that is, often very good indeed, and often of direct applicability to a client's needs. So I don't believe that teaching has no research impacts at all. I think teaching and research going together have lots of impacts. But that's just a view. Let's just see if we've got any more questions to round up on, and then we'll finish.
Michael Raymond from the University of the Highlands and Islands. There was an awful lot of debate and discussion ahead of the formation of refugee, what it is and the clusters it is, but a lot of discussion about use of citations. And there's a little bit of a touch, I think, at the end of the day, which says that the panels themselves would decide what use they would make of citations and then tell us all when the criteria working method statements are released, and hopefully they'll say something on that next month. But part of the reason for that, of course, is that if you're using citations as a measure of impact, and the measure of impact you're talking about is really other academics citing the work done by other academics, it kind of misses the interface in one sense with the impact on society, which is the method. Measure. So I'm getting a little bit of mixed messages about what we're actually talking about with impacts and how citations really do fit into that.
Okay. There was a yes.
Karen Ross from the University of Liverpool. Just a comment, just to say that there will be a consultation in July, which is what Michael's just said, and that's our opportunity. We have a very small window of opportunity to actually feed into that process. So, in some ways, part of what we could be doing as individuals and as groups in our institutions is actually taking part in that consultation rather than thinking, oh, it's July, I need to go on holiday. It will be July, we do need to go on holiday, but we could spend a little bit of time just trying to have an influence, because I think the sub-panels are really interested in having a consultation wider than themselves. And I think it's down to us, isn't it, to try and do what we can to influence at the only moment that we can do that, which is in that three-month consultation period.
Good.
David McQueen from Bournemouth University. We had a slightly worrying presentation at Bournemouth University about impacts. One of them was from Portsmouth University. It's Professor Ian Stewart, I think it is, who's published 30,000 books, has a series on the BBC, reaches millions of people, and scored zero because it was written poorly, apparently. I'm just wondering how badly it was. One point to make, the link wasn't made explicitly between his original research and the output. So there seems to be a very mechanistic, black and white judgment about tracing that through in a linear way. And that's, I think, one of the things we have to be very concerned about, that a lot of things are going to fall through the drain, particularly the stuff with WikiLeaks and Wikipedia and blogs. I mean, can you make an explicit link back to your original research and then show the impact as easily as this ref process seems to suggest we can?
Okay, very good. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, Molly Morgan-Jones from RAND Europe. I just wanted to come back to this issue of citations and bibliometrics and what Claire Donovan and some others were saying. I mean, the work of Linda Butler, also people like Charles Oppenheim and Diana Hicks, and is very grounded in a huge body of research. And I think while I appreciate saying to academics it's easy to use Publisher Parish or Google Scholar, I think we need to be very careful about how we promote that in the wider community, because I think it would be very bad to have policymakers going to Google Scholar and not understanding the context and the subtleties of publications and citations and all of the different metrics you can use around that to understand what impact actually is in a wider sense. And I've been part of work to look at what would a database for the social sciences and humanities look like. And I think there are a lot of very subtle issues in there that we need to be careful about how we share that with the wider community.
It has a slightly alchemical feel about it. You're an alchemist. You want to keep this to a group of the elect. You don't want to use open source, sort of open book kind of software.
I don't feel
because
that.
People
I don't,
might
no.
misconstrue. Is that
no,
what you're
I don't feel that at all. I think it is potentially dangerous for policymakers to just go and look at the citations of a person just based on Google Scholar, and that could miss out a whole bunch of. It could underestimate the person's work, it could overestimate the impact, and I think without understanding what the context of those numbers are, I think that's dangerous, which I would think you would sympathise with.
The trouble is that is how policymakers do it now. They use Google the same as the rest of us
I
do.
Know, so I'm just saying maybe we should think about, you know.
If you talk to civil servants and you say, how did you get to X when you were consulting on this policy? And they say, well, the minister said you've got to have something by tomorrow, and I went on the open web and I just pulled it off. I'm afraid that, you know, we live in a digital world now. We can't sort of keep it closed to a little alchemical set. And I think that's really what people who promote ISI and the Scopus, they've tended to in the past really be promoting a very sectional or sectarian kind of view of academic life. And, you know, Google Scholar and Google Books are not totally without flaws. There's things wrong with all of them. But they're very easy to use. They bring a lot more information to the public domain. I think they could be very helpful, you know, just using Harzing if you're an academic. If you want to know which of your publications have worked and which haven't, you know, every time I look at it, I think, Christ, why did I spend so much time on all these 30 projects that have got no references or just one reference, you know? I think it's very hard to get better at achieving impact without looking at, you know, how you're doing. And the important thing is that this should be a very democratically available capability. It shouldn't be just restricted to a closed group of bibliometricians and to the Times Higher and the
it's
idiotic
not
news leaks.
Thank you.
That would be what of my reaction. Sorry. I think citations is a very academic thing. It's very incestuous. It tells you what other academics are doing, and that's what I would use if I was trying to assess research quality. I don't really believe in the views of panels and the judgments produced by committees. I know I'm in a minority, but I hope it's a growing minority of people who would like to see an open source, open book method of assessing academic influence. And on the whole, you know, if stuff is being picked up and cited, that's a good evidence that it's being useful. And if it's not, it's very damaging when you look at all the things, as I say, on your list that haven't been cited or never took off. But it's very helpful, I think. And does it link to? Well, there is a link to impacts in the way that James mentioned. But on the whole, most policymakers don't have, you know, subscriptions to all these different journals, and they just go on the open web, and that's what they use. So we live in a digital world, and I just advise everyone to grips with it. And I very much agree with Karen that everybody should get involved in the consultations with the sub-panels and trying to influence the process as much as they can.
I think there was just one question about how you write up the.
I'm just wondering about templates. You know,
yeah.
Let's have some more examples of good, of well-written narratives.
Yeah.
Because they're saying this has got zero. This incredible.
Yeah.
You know, this professor
is
reaching.
This is Ian Stewart, the mathematics, the pop academic mathematics guy.
Is he mathematics or sciences?
Yeah, I mean, just from the people that we've talked to, how you write up the case studies is really key. And I think possibly, yeah, there are now access to a lot of the ones that went into the pilots,
but only the good ones. We haven't got any publications, I think, of the ones that were zero rated, have we? Or one rated. So, you have to kind of construe from what the panel has said is a good one as to what features they were looking at. And again, that's not an open book process. It's rather typical of Hefke that it's a closed book world where you can't challenge and you can't... We live in an open book age. If they're making judgments, they should put them all up on the web. If they can't justify them, then they shouldn't have made a judgment in the first place. That would be my opinion.
I'm so sorry, but I'm afraid we're going to have to... we've got a tea break now, and then in 15 minutes, we're the next session, so I'm...